Hello and welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I am your host, Madalina Jakob, co-managing editor of DebtWire North America. I am glad to be joined today by Olivia Gawthorne, managing director in Oaktree's Opportunities Group in New York, where she focuses on opportunistic investments, primarily within the healthcare sector. She joined the firm in 2023 from Apollo Global Management, where she served as a managing director in the Global Corporate Credit Group and led the healthcare sector coverage. Previously, Olivia was a senior analyst for the Brookfield Credit Opportunities Fund. Welcome to the show, Olivia.
Thanks, Natalina. Very happy to be here.
Olivia, to start off, before we dive into the latest market topics, could you briefly describe your role at Oaktree and give us an overview of the firm's opportunistic strategy?
Sure. So Oaktree's global opportunity strategy invests across both public and private markets, and we've been investing for 38 years now out of this strategy. We have a flexible mandate to pursue the most interesting opportunities across the capital structure and deliver attractive returns for our investors. And we focus a lot on risk control and downside protection. That's very inherent to our investment philosophy. And in terms of my role, to facilitate the deepening of our sector expertise and to help with sourcing proprietary private capital solutions, our team is now organized into sector verticals, one of which is healthcare. And my role is to lead the healthcare sector team, overseeing sourcing, underwriting, monitoring of investment performance, as well as making portfolio management recommendations for our healthcare investments.
What types of situations are you typically focused on, or where do you have the most flexibility across the cap structure?
Well, as I mentioned, we have flexibility to invest in both public and private markets and have flexibility to invest in debt. We'll do structured equity. We can also do more regular way equity. So really go where we see the best opportunities. When we're investing in liquid markets, we're typically purchasing debt at a discount. And we're looking for large companies where we can deploy a lot of capital, and really good companies with bad balance sheets is our ideal. And sometimes maybe we're playing for a turnaround of the business, or think we can help effectuate an improvement in the capital structure. And we're often looking at a lot of sectors that are out of favor or experiencing some sort of dislocation. On the private side, there's a couple types of deal profiles we typically would look at. The first are rescue financings, and that would be maybe the company needs liquidity, or maybe they need to refinance a more difficult maturity. The second, maybe the company needs some more opportunistic type capital. So they want to do M&A, or they need to finance a growth strategy. And so we can provide them with a solution to address that. And the third would be maybe we'll back a management team in a specific sector and do more of a platform deal that management team can expand and grow their business. And lastly, I would just say there's a couple, I think, factors that make our solutions more attractive in the private markets. And that's the speed at which we can underwrite and really the expertise of the team in the sectors in which we specialize, as well as our ability to understand and analyze from a bottoms-up perspective complex business models. And then that coupled with the size of the capital we're able to deploy and really the certainty we're able to keep these companies with our solutions.
Exactly. And if we shift a little bit from Oaktree's mandate to the broader backdrop investors are navigating today, we have geopolitical uncertainty, we have higher but stable interest rates, and then we have the recent AI-driven sell-off in the software market. How are you thinking about positioning your capital today, given all these pressures?
We think there's a lot to be cautious about in the current markets. Credit markets are at all-time tights. The equity markets are at all-time highs. And it seems like the market is looking for reasons to look through some of these potentially very impactful macroeconomic risks. But underlying that overarching factor that credit is very tight, we are seeing a lot of dispersion. And particularly one area where there's a lot of dispersion is in software. And we're trying to find the proverbial baby out with the bathwater, but recognize that we're very early in this AI evolution, and there are a lot of known unknowns. And so I think we're taking a cautious and measured approach to investing and underwriting in sectors where we think there might be more AI exposure, but we think there's going to be a lot of opportunity.
One area where this pressure seemed to be especially acute that we talked about, including AI, is healthcare, which is your focus. This sector has seen a lot of headwinds over the past years between Medicare and Medicaid rate pressure and cuts, labor inflation and staffing shortages from COVID. And now you have the AI-driven sell-off. How do you think about risk and opportunity in healthcare today?
Certainly, policy risk remains elevated. There's a number of initiatives that continue to play out and span many different healthcare subsectors in terms of their impact. So we're still seeing the impacts of the One Big Beautiful Bill on Medicaid reimbursement. And also we're watching what the impact of the expiration of the Enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies will have on healthcare services companies. Additionally, there's been an increased focus on fraud, waste, and abuse, particularly in Medicaid-exposed services businesses. So we continue to see a lot of policy initiatives that are causing that dispersion. And then coming back to AI, disruptive technology impacts healthcare as well, both in subsectors like healthcare IT, but also in others like pharma services. And then there's also other disruptive technologies like GLP-1s that may have downstream effects on how we use the broader healthcare systems. So I think all of those factors are translating into this meaningful dislocation we continue to see within healthcare. And we think it's a great environment for folks like us that do bottoms-up analysis and can really select the best situations and opportunities.
You seem to be very busy. I mean, where do you find value? I'm curious, are there some subsectors that look more resilient and some that you're saying, I'm not going to touch though, because there's so much uncertainty with the Medicare cuts and so on? Definitely, we've seen loans of some of these companies that are affected by the cuts trade down a lot in the past month.
Yes, definitely. I would say areas where we're finding more value right now are med devices and also pharma. Interestingly, it feels like some of those potential policy changes, the range of outcomes has become a bit more clear for pharma around drug pricing. And additionally, for both med devices and pharma, we've kind of moved a little bit beyond the tariff concerns that we saw last year that pressured those spaces. So we feel like there's a bit more certainty on the overall outlook for those subsectors. And I think additionally, as you mentioned, the Medicaid areas of healthcare services are a bit more challenged, but there are many other areas of healthcare services that we think probably don't have meaningful negative AI impacts and also may see the benefits from a productivity perspective. And then I would say conversely, in healthcare IT and pharma services, where we think there's the most potential AI risk and disruption and dislocation, we're taking a much finer lens on how we're underwriting and evaluating opportunities in those spaces today.
What qualities are you looking for in these types of credits? You mentioned healthcare IT.
Yeah. So I think this can be applied even more broadly to software in general, but there are a number of characteristics that we will look for. So one, does the company have proprietary data? Is there data that's actually created in the use of this software that's unique to the platform we are underwriting? Two, is there a network effect to using this software? And is there a significant amount of organizational change that is needed to switch, which would create more of a moat?
You need CapEx more, no? Or to implement AI, or not necessarily? You're not looking at the spend. Do they have the bandwidth to implement AI?
We're definitely, I think capital structure matters a lot as well. Does the target company's capital structure allow the business to invest and make sure that they don't fall behind? Some of the other things, inherent qualities in the business that we look for are like, is the software embedded in their customers' key processes? Is it really critical to the operation of their customers? And is it a system of record? And then is there any sort of regulatory overlay that may make it more difficult to switch? I would also add that who your customer is, we think, really matters. So the more diversified, the smaller the actual customers are, the less sophisticated they are, mm-hmm. the less likely they are to insource or to use AI to try to substitute for something else. So mm-hmm. we spend a lot of time thinking about who the customer is. And then lastly, I think you were kind of getting at this, but the market positioning of these existing software players, are they the best in class incumbent, or are there many different incumbents and it's a much more competitive environment?
So that takes me to the next question. What are you afraid of? And basically you're actively avoiding because you think these companies could become obsolete.
So we think about healthcare IT, if we're looking at that specifically, and those subsectors along a spectrum of how insulated these businesses and their business models may be from AI risks. And we think that provider IT, so that's software that helps doctors, hospitals, physicians, et cetera, is more insulated than payer IT. And payer IT would be software that provides services to insurance companies. And the reason that is because we are concerned over insourcing risk with the national payers who have significant resources. Some of them even have very, very large healthcare IT businesses that they own themselves. And they really will likely have the ability and expertise to harness AI to potentially serve their own needs, be that in payment integrity or claims repricing. Again, we think provider IT should be more insulated versus payer IT. And then on the provider IT side, we think ambulatory businesses that focus on much smaller physician practices and electronic health records or practice management software will be most insulated. And that's because their systems of record, they're really the core of the operations of these practices, and there's significant change management that's required to churn off of those pieces of software. And then revenue cycle management, which helps providers get paid and solve the claims process, we think lands somewhere in the middle. There are certain solutions that are stickier and more difficult to switch, but others we think may become more commoditized.
Moving forward, you pointed there's also a sizable backlog of healthcare services companies that haven't transacted in recent years. And I just want to ask if you think deal activity is going to pick up in this subsector.
We think we could see more activity in healthcare services M&A, and that would finally be a pickup, really as a result of subsector rotations. So much of healthcare private equity investment in recent years has been in healthcare IT and pharma services. And as mentioned before, both of those subsectors right now have the most debate about the impact AI will have on their moats. And we do think there could be increased activity in areas where AI is less of an existential risk and potentially more of a boon to their productivity and margins. And healthcare services is an area where that may be the case.
We'll see. We'll keep an eye on that.
We'll see.
On that part. Yeah.
It'll be interesting. Yeah.
Now, I can't have you on the podcast without talking about private credit. This is an area that's also under intense scrutiny, especially given the pressure across the software and the technology borrowers, private credit borrowers. So what trends, I'm curious, Olivia, you mentioned in the beginning of the podcast that you look at both markets, liquid and private. What trends are you seeing now in private credit?
So, you know, we are seeing that some private credit firms are deploying smaller checks or may be out of the market for certain types of deals. And that has translated into more vanilla private credit spreads widening out 25, maybe 50 basis points from where they were. I think also one interesting thing we're starting to see is some portfolios of private credit loans start to trade. And so far, it's been very orderly, and the initial portfolios have been comprised of what we would think of as higher quality credits. And so they've transacted at high prices. But I think it's going to be very interesting to see if selling expands, if redemptions continue. And we're spending a lot of time preparing and trying to information gather to make sure we're standing under the hoop to the extent this becomes a bigger opportunity.
Yeah, because this was the mantra, private credit doesn't trade, right? And now we're seeing that. That's pretty huge.
Yes. Some of those barriers that people have always pointed to in terms of relationships and as well as information access, AI and the amount of software that is in private credit and the potential need for liquidity are going to test some of those historically held views about whether or not it will trade. And I think figuring out how to get access to information if you're not an existing lender, and also folks who have existing relationships with these sponsors and can step into these loans and buy them. There's a small subset, and we think we're very well positioned to do that.
Because it's not the pool of loans or specific loans? It would be like BDC entirely or specific loans that you can cherry pick?
I think it really depends on the portfolio. We've seen opportunities so far for both to buy portfolios, to buy specific names out of these portfolios. But again, I think so far, things have been very orderly and again, of the higher quality, and we'll see where this goes.
So you mentioned how hard it is to get information in this in this market. So how do you get comfortable underwriting these private credit loans when access to information isn't really there all the time?
Certainly, there's always a base level of information we're going to require as bottoms-up fundamental investors. And we're, like I said, very focused on figuring out ways to get access to that information to the extent there's a bigger opportunity here to buy private credit. At the same time, I would also say that we have a long history of investing in public markets, and we're comfortable making decisions with imperfect information and figuring out alternative ways to get information and data on companies to develop a very fully formed thesis. So combining both of those factors, we think we'll be able to come to a fully formed view.
Because Oaktree always wanted to have bigger positions. So I assume it's the same idea here. You would go and buy private loans and you would like to have a sizable position that gives you weight at the negotiating table if you need to get to the table.
Yes, yes. We always, to quote Hamilton, want to be in the room where it happens. And so we make sure that we position ourselves in these capital structures to be in the steering committee, to have influence. And we think we have a long history of being a constructive player within those negotiations.
Exactly. Now, you've invested throughout several major credit cycles. So I want to shift our discussion a little bit on your experience over the years, because you've spent two decades investing in stress, distress through the great financial crisis, COVID, then the rapid rise in interest rates. And we've talked about the AI impact, both on private credit and on your specific sector, healthcare. How do you view today's disruption, AI-driven disruption, in this context? Does it feel different?
Yeah, I think there are a few things that are really interesting about the credit markets AI woes today. So the first is that software is a very large component of the levered loan indices and as well of the private credit markets. Software is the largest concentration in the leveraged loan index at 14%. It's a bit smaller in the high yield bond index, but it's 21%, we estimate, of the private credit market. So it's very big. It's a very big sector. I think also historically, software was viewed as having very strong credit profiles that supported high levels of leverage, and historically was viewed as recession resilient. They have asset light business models with recurring revenue, high margins, high free cash flow. So all of these things that we would typically think would make for very good credits. And so there's a lot of leverage on a lot of these companies, given these deals were done in a different technology environment. And the last factor I think that's really interesting is just the rate of change we're seeing in technology right now is faster than we've ever seen. So coupled together, that makes for a very interesting environment. And right now, the distressed leveraged loan universe, so defined as loans sub 80, is 45% technology. And that's roughly $61 billion of distressed software debt. And that doesn't even include private credit. And we really have just even started to scratch the surface of potential impacts to these actual businesses. We've seen valuations compress, but many of these businesses haven't even seen any disruptive effects yet. So
the real effect.
And we think this is going to be a really big opportunity over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yes, because we also have the maturity wall in loan market. So you mentioned this unprecedented disruption. Do you think it could have a profound impact on credit markets, especially as we're looking at this huge maturity wall in the loan market? A large volume of loans are coming due around 2028.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the time frame between now and likely early 2027. So about a year between when one would typically want to refinance a lot of these loans. Obviously, the environment for new software investments has changed. And so I think it's going to be more challenging, especially within that sector where there's real secular concerns. But again, kind of coming back to why we think it's such a good opportunity for folks like us who do bottoms-up analysis, there's these concerns, but not every business is created equal. And finding the ones that really are insulated and able to weather the potential disruption, I think will be a great opportunity.
Now, alongside these broader market shifts that we talked about, the restructuring landscape itself has evolved significantly in the past years, because we've seen a rapid evolution of liability management exercises, cooperation agreement, creditor group formation. Do you think liability management exercises are genuinely providing issuers meaningful runway and flexibility, or they're primarily just delaying a more comprehensive restructuring? More broadly, how do you think about capital solutions in today's environment?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the business, the fundamentals, and the underlying sector. And that's why we think that bottom-up analysis and the sector expertise we have is really important. We've seen, though, businesses where giving the company additional liquidity and runway to turn around or to execute a sale has worked. And then there are others where it is more of a bridge to nowhere or a bridge to a restructuring. And it does really depend on the situation. I think the other thing to consider from lender's perspective is that most of the time, it's not as simple as choosing an LME or choosing a bankruptcy. There's often a third door where something quite negative could happen to lenders' collateral. And there are a lot of factors to weigh when, as lenders, you're trying to choose the path to go down.
I know what you're saying. The threat of a deal away or of that collateral being pledged to for a third-party financing, and then the lenders are primed. Some liability management exercises we've seen, LME 2, 3, and then Chapter 11. So they tried twice, and the third time it had to go into Chapter 11 to do a more comprehensive and deliver the cap structure. But Oaktree also has seen the creditor landscape change, because in the past, negotiations were largely among opportunistic funds. Some of them were more vultures than others, like we used to call them. But today we have CLOs. They are often, if not all the time, par buyers who are major players in this situation, in these LMEs and co-op groups. So how does that shift change the dynamic at the negotiation table when you have opportunistic funds like Oaktree that have evolved and are looking at capital solutions as well, but you're still a different animal than the CLOs?
So I think CLOs being part of the equation isn't exactly a new phenomenon, but I would say that creditor groups are organizing earlier, and less of that transition to opportunistic holders hasn't happened the earlier these groups form. I think one of the challenges in any creditor group is navigating through diversity of opinion and diversity of goals. But as CLOs have evolved more, their docs nowadays have a lot more flexibility than they once did in terms of the types of consideration they can take. And the more flexibility they have, the less uneconomic constraints they have, the more aligned holders can be, and it makes it easier for us all to coalesce around a deal. There's always dispute and discussion and robust conversation about which path to take within these groups.
Some of the CLOs were complaining about not being able to get out at some point of a credit, let's say LME 2, because during LME number 1, the sponsor asked for some funds, let's say opportunistic funds, to be added to a disqualification list, a DQ list. And I'm curious, how do you see that? So they were complaining, I need that liquidity. I don't want these funds to be on that list because if I want to sell in the 80s, if the loan moves from 70 to 80s, I want to get out. I just want to sell it to somebody like O3 or another fund. So I'm curious, how do you see these DQ lists? Obviously a new phenomenon. We haven't really seen them when you started, right?
The expanding DQ list has been more of a recent phenomenon, and it's certainly not, you know, advantageous to lenders, and it can meaningfully reduce liquidity and cause prices to drop materially if it's unable to find that new buyer base and allow them to come into the structure. It is something, as we're doing the liability management exercise, we will try to protect against in the documentation. Now that, you know, this is becoming more of a trend, there are things you can put in the documents to put some guardrails around how widespread the DQ list can be. And so that's one way to try to combat this trend. And then also I would say the new buyer base that may be, if they find themselves on the DQ list, going to the sponsor and explaining why it's beneficial to have lower cost base holders. And there can also be a solution that has worked in certain situations. And so appealing to their interests as well as the new buyer bases.
And you can change their thoughts.
It depends on the situation.
Depends on the sponsor. And since we talked about groups, I want to ask you a little bit about co-op. When you're evaluating joining a co-op, what are the key factors driving that decision, and what's your experience with co-ops?
Every situation has its unique set of facts and circumstances, but I would say if the co-op is of the same class of creditors, it tends to be better to be in the group, in the room, join versus on the outside. I think the decision becomes a bit more complicated if we're talking about a co-op that spans maybe multiple tranches, maybe more senior, more junior, who may have differing incentives. And so then those key facts and circumstances and what might happen in the credit becomes a much bigger part of the decision-making process.
Also, there are some issues sometimes if they expire, right? What do you do with them? Is that an issue or not necessarily? You get their
life after the co-op is is becoming a very interesting topic. And where do we go from post-co-op is a very interesting question. And again, I think really comes back to those unique set of facts and circumstances and what the incentives of the different layers of the capital structure are at the time of expiry.
Because this is life after co-op. If no LME has happened in the meantime, right?
Yes. That's what we're saying. Or no restructuring.
No transaction, no deal with the company.
Yeah.
Lenders organize proactively. Have you noticed since we talk about under co-op and it's sometimes led by documentation and sometimes the sponsors are driving the co-op formation, sometimes the lenders, I feel like, want to protect themselves because they feel there could be an LME, the loans traded down. Have you seen any recent changes in LME documentation or the deal structures?
Definitely. The deal structures and subsequently the LME documentation are ever evolving to address new technology. I think we've obviously seen many typical deal structures like unsubs or non-guarantor restricted sub third-party deals. Now we're hearing things about inside-out transactions and non-sub deals. There's always new technology that is coming up in these. And I think in turn, LME documentation, right, is really about tightening up these holes. And so as we see new technology threatened as a third-party deal, the LME documentation is evolving to try to protect against that.
And you're seeing this from the sponsors, right? From the the lawyers and everybody who's representing the company, the sponsors coming up with all these ideas to preserve their optionality.
Yes. Yes, some of these have been transactions in, and some of these are more in the lab, I would say.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah, we've seen some deal aways as well recently that picking up, but some of them were structured more like to give lenders more time to provide their own solutions. Mm-hmm. There were some companies who did some deal aways like Kik. I don't know if you want to touch on third-party deal away.
In terms of...
Do you see them in the healthcare sector or...
We haven't seen one in a while, but they are threatened in every single liability management transaction we negotiate. And those negotiations are a lot about thinking about, is the sponsor incentivized to do this? How far away is the maturity? What leverage do we as lenders have? What leverage does the sponsor have? Are there other creditors in the capital structure that have other incentives? There definitely have been third-party deals done more recently in the market, but every situation is very fact-specific as to why one would happen or not. But I think there's a lot of reasons why ultimately many deals get done with the existing lender group, because there are things existing lenders can offer the company and the sponsor that a third party can't, like an extension of a maturity. Exactly. And that, I think, continues to often be the goal.
Even sometimes lower cost of capital.
Yes. Yeah.
So now taking a step back from today's market dynamics, I'd love to hear a bit about your own path into the industry, because you've watched this market evolve dramatically and change over the past 20 years. Can you tell us how you started in distressed debt and how the market today is different from when you began?
Yeah. I had quite an intro to distressed and opportunistic investing. I started my career in high-yield research at Lehman Brothers in 2007. So you can probably see where the story is going. The week before Lehman filed for bankruptcy in 2008, I got moved to the distress desk. They needed more analysts given the opportunity set. And at the time, I was very happy to just have a job. And it seems like a great time to learn about distress, but it was definitely right into the deep end. And I ended up really falling in love with the complexity and the game theory around the process. And it was an amazing learning experience to be in that environment. And one of my favorite parts of this story is that the first bankruptcy hearing I ever listened to was my own company's sale hearing, which felt
unbelievable.
Like a very fitting introduction into the space.
And then moving forward, so you basically now worked at Barclays, right? After it was bought?
Yeah, for 6 years after that. And since my time at Barclays, you know, I've seen a number of evolutions. I think there's two big ones I would call out. So first would be just the evolution of opportunistic investing to include more private capital solutions. So when I started, there were a lot of strategies that were purely liquid credit and purely distressed liquid credit. And really over the last 10 years, folks have needed to evolve their structure and the flexibility to really deploy into private deals. And that really expands the way in which we're able to approach a situation. We can look at it from buying debt in the secondary, or we can look at it from providing a new money investment. It also makes the strategy a lot more all-weather. And the capital bases of opportunistic funds have had to evolve in the structure of those matters now that there's a lot more private capital solutions. And then for investment professionals in these seats, there's a new set of skills that you need. There's industry expertise, there's relationships in those industries. You have to navigate a private diligence process, which is different from looking at things in the
SEC
public
filings, yeah.
Markets, yeah. So that has definitely been a very major evolution I've witnessed. And the second, I think, is just how important scale is now. And I don't think they're completely unrelated, but investment outcomes, I think, are really generated by size and scale today, and the ability to have an influence in the process, as we were talking about before, and being in that room where it happens has never mattered more. And then also on the private side, being able to write large checks can really differentiate you as a lender in a private situation. So I think the importance of scale would be the other evolution I'd call out.
That's so interesting. And yeah, I'll keep this in mind that you covered your own about bankruptcy the first year. Yeah, it's and then you did you have to cover it throughout the because it was a long emergence.
No, I actually didn't cover Lehman. The reason I was listening to was more self-serving, and that we wanted to make sure that the sale to Barclays was going close.
That you have a job basically.
Yeah, exactly. So
gives you a good insight into it.
Yeah, it was super interesting that my team, the distress desk at the time, was also advising like all of the internal people at Lehman about the likelihood and like what the bankruptcy judge was saying, because they had the expertise at the time about the process. And so it was very interesting to witness. I think I actually still have my notes from the hearing, because it was just such a historic moment.
It was a historic moment. Yeah. Exactly. My first hearing is not so interesting. Trico Marine Services. But I remember the time, September 2010, because it was the first time I had to listen to a bankruptcy hearing. So I did prepare a lot before. But yeah. And so now I guess we're ready to wrap up our discussion. But I really want to ask you just two more questions. One would be going back to healthcare, and another one just looking broader at the market and in the next year. So when we talk about healthcare, just a quick question on what are some structural issues that make this sector different than more cyclical credit stories? This is your expertise.
I think there's a couple things. So one, there's been significant private equity investment in healthcare, similar to software, and that's been driven by a number of factors that are viewed attractively for healthcare. It has a very large TAM. There's an aging population in the U.S. Demand is theoretically less discretionary, although there's probably an asterisk there. And so healthcare is also a very large sector in the high yield universe and leverage loan universe. And there were many deals done in the 2021 and 2022 timeframe, which was a very different rate environment that resulted in a lot of very levered capital structures with high fixed charges. And now that we're in a different rate environment, a lot of those companies are experiencing more cash flow concerns, but there are a lot of good companies in that bucket. I think some of the other things we also talked about have added to the pressures we're seeing, and that's persistent policy changes and initiatives, the after effects of the COVID-19 pandemic still being felt throughout our system. And then technology, AI, we talked about GLP-1s. So all of these factors combined has kind of created that persistent dislocation and dispersion among healthcare credit.
And then lastly, as maturities that we talked about are stacking up over the next 12 to 24 months, what's your overall market outlook? And what should investors be watching most closely to determine how stress will evolve?
Yeah, I think, as we said before, there's a lot to be cautious on from a credit market perspective. We think the markets continue to try to look through a lot of these potentially really impactful risks, but we think dispersion is here to stay, and it's a great environment for bottoms up analysis and opportunistic investors like ourselves. In terms of what we should be watching, at least from an AI perspective, watching for that actual disruption happening to companies and playing into their earnings, because we haven't really seen that yet. And so keeping a close eye on the companies you're looking at's initiatives, how some of the big players are evolving, and how other incumbents are playing is going to be really important to see if we move past just these valuation impacts, actually start to see, you know, real business disruption. And then on the topic of private credit, I would say continue to watch BDC redemptions as a potential signal for further portfolio monetizations.
Meaning like trading.
Yeah.
On this note, we will wrap up today's conversation. Olivia, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your insights with us.
Thank you. It was great.
And thank you everyone for listening. As always, you can subscribe to or download every episode on Apple or Spotify and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwire.com.